This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine crisis, Taiwan crisis. I welcome Mary Kissel, Executive Vice President Stevens Incorporated, former senior advisor to the Secretary of State. We begin with Ukraine crisis. Mary, I define the Ukraine crisis in terms of language from the 1937 to 1940 crisis, but it applies. There is the party of peace, and in 1937 and 1940, that dominated in the cabinet meetings in Paris and London. And there is the party of justice that in 1937 and 1940 said there is no justice in surrendering Austria and Czechoslovakia and other parts of Europe to an aggressor state. That would have been Berlin. The party of justice today, I observe, is led by voices from the Eastern European Union. That would be Poland, the Baltic states, Czechia, Romania certainly are involved. In these last days, you know, June 16th, the leaders of three major old European Union powerhouses, Italy, France, and Germany, visited in Kiev along with the leader, the president of Romania, and sat with Mr. President Zelensky and promised support. But they were on the eve of a European Union meeting. The European Union has offered an accelerated path for Ukraine to join the EU. Is this a winding down of the war, Mary? How do you measure this? They've offered a diplomatic solution. Mr. Draghi has offered what is called Minsk III, a complicated form of negotiation. Is the war ending in some diplomatic fashion now? Good day to you.
Good day to you, John. No, the war isn't ending. It presses on. While I think it's important and good to see the symbolism of these three important European leaders, going to Kyiv and meeting Volodymyr Zelensky and his staff, what they're doing is proposing something in the future that may not exist. Because if Russia wins this war, then there will be no modern Ukraine to join the European Union. And that's really the rub of it. It's not about the symbolism. It's about the weapons that these European nations will or will not supply to empower the Ukrainians to fight back. And it's about whether or not Europe is going to get serious about sanctioning Russian companies. The United States will get serious about imposing secondary sanctions on companies that do business with these sanctioned entities. We haven't seen that so far, and that tells me that really what the European leaders want is an off-ramp that Ukrainians and their people do not want, and therefore this war is going to drag on for some time longer.
Mr. Macron, President Macron, is now qualified in some fashion by parliamentary elections, legislative elections. However, he is a long time, very clear voice that he wants an accommodation with Moscow. He has said repeatedly he does not seek an end that humiliates Putin. Is that either desirable or possible, Mary, given the conflict?
Well, the French president just lost legitimacy within his own country. His party indeed won the most seats in the National Assembly election in these past days. But the French voters sent a very clear message that they're not happy with Macron. The only reason they voted for him for president is because they didn't want to vote for Marine Le Pen. And they have handed more power to a far-left coalition and to a far-right coalition with which Macron and his allies will now have to contend in parliament. So I think Macron's ambitions to be some sort of European superstate leader, though that really can't happen if he doesn't enjoy some sort of governing power at home. And France is a mess. And that is deeply unfortunate because when Macron came into power, he came into power as a kind of new reformer. He talked about doing some very common sense things to revive the French economy, wean its dependence off the state, and encourage investment, and to encourage young French entrepreneurs to return to the country. But frankly, he's made a mess of it. And that will impact, I think, his ability to exert diplomacy on his neighbors. And in any event, it's not the kind of diplomacy that's going to end in a success anyway, because if he thinks that he can go to Putin and say, hey, let's make a deal, and think that he can trust this guy after the terror death that he's visited upon Ukraine. And I think he's got another thing coming.
We also have threats against Great Britain within these last hours. And it complicates every matter because the British people are overwhelmed with potential strikes at the railhead, a lack of airplanes to get out of Europe, get out of Britain, and also the what they call the cost of living. So everybody is going in different directions. But at the same time, Vladimir Putin, oddly, is making more threats. This is fresh. Russia's newly tested intercontinental ballistic missile, known as Satan II, will be deployed by the end of the year, Vladimir Putin has warned. The Russian president said in these hours he would strengthen the country's armed forces following substantial losses in Ukraine, called his troops real heroes. We will continue to develop and strengthen our armed forces, taking into account potential military threats and risks, said Mr. Putin. There is no doubt we will be even stronger. He then goes on to make references that this missile can reach Britain. It is puzzling, Mary. We have discord here between the aggressor state, Moscow, making no attempt to hide the ambition here to continue to press the attack and to strengthen the military for subsequent adventures, and the voices in Europe seeking a way to close down the fighting and come to negotiation, which means, as we know, the Donbass. So, because we're on the eve of the European Union, let's look to another possibility. The U.S., where are we in this? Because the administration has pledged arms again and again over these last months, more than 100 days now. And those arms, from my reading, don't seem to have any restrictions. They're more and more lethal, and the heavy artillery is moving. Is the U.S. as deeply committed to Kyiv's victory as some parts of the European Union seem to be?
Well, I think the Biden administration's instincts are closer to those of Emmanuel Macron than to their predecessors in the Trump administration. What do I mean by that? I mean that they seek conciliation and appeasement, and they've done that with Putin since they entered office. They greenlighted the New START treaty without exacting any serious concessions from Moscow. They were gave a green light to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which further tied Germany to Russian gas. They indicated to Putin verbally in their rhetoric that as long as the invasion of Ukraine wasn't too big, that, you know, we wouldn't really do anything. And then when Putin threatened, the president immediately took the option of putting U.S. troops on the ground off the table. Now, that last statement may have been a prudent thing to do. And to give the Biden team some credit here, they have reversed themselves on many of those issues. They came out against Nord Stream 2. They did impose sanctions on Russia, albeit incomplete. They did ship weapons in. They have done an 180-degree turn on many policy measures, but not because that's what they want to do. I think it's because the political pressure out of Capitol Hill was so great and so bipartisan that they felt compelled to do it because of domestic political concerns. So where do they go from here? Well, I think, again, they're trying to conciliate. Remember, they offered Zelensky a ride out of Kyiv, which he rejected. But they are still now working to see if they can come to some sort of agreement to stop the fighting. I think what Vladimir Putin's statements that you mentioned, I think what they signal is that his strategy on the other side is equally clear. He is trying to deter the West, and he is in large part succeeding. The sanctions are not complete. The Russian economy has not collapsed. We have not put physical troops there on the ground. We have refrained from sending fighter jets that Ukraine has requested into the country. So if this is a game of chicken, then I think you have to say that Moscow is winning to date. And that's unfortunate because it has significant costs in Ukrainian lives.
Energy. The energy story dominates the conversations because willy-nilly over these last days, Russia has been turning down the gas lines. Europe is making accommodation as best it can. For example, there's a headline this morning saying that some parts of the German energy system is restarting their coal-fired plants. We know that Mario Draghi has made accommodation by seeking natural gas in Africa, I believe. And there are others, there are other ways to deal with the energy downturn. For example, there's a heat wave across the Mediterranean basin. And in Italy, I know they've been asked to turn the air conditioner either off or down. So everybody's adjusting. At the same time, there's a timeline here, Mary. And we have to believe that the sinister voices in the Kremlin understand that energy is the source of prosperity. And without prosperity, there's no confidence in leadership. Does that favor Moscow? And does that indicate that there's a countdown to how long the war can go on before Europe looks to make a separate peace?
Well, look, Europe is getting mugged by reality. Berlin restarting coal-fired plants is a clear indication of that. The Wall Street Journal reported Germany imports about 35% of its gas from Russia. That is down from a little more than 55% before the war. So they're trying to move away from dependence on Russia because now they have to. And they have the summer and the autumn months to do that. So there's a period of time here. The problem is that gas contracts are forged for, you know, long periods of time because these are big, expensive deals. And so the producers need some sort of certainty that if they invest the money to extract the gas and ship it, that they will have a steady stream of income. So you see a huge effort to get long-term contracts now signed, particularly with the Middle East, with places like Qatar, with Australia, with the United States. But, you know, these facilities also take quite some time to construct. So there is a prospect that the coming winter will be a very cold one in continental Europe.
There's a German word I've learned, Mary, in these last hours, Kriegsmüdigkeit, meaning war weariness. I know that it's in Europe. Is it in America? Do you sense that Wall Street distracted by the recession talk and Washington distracted by polling and America distracted by the price of gasoline at the pump is turning away from Ukraine? That's your business. That's far away. And we're not sure we could find it on a map. Is that happening, Mary?
Well, certainly geography matters. And the more immediately you are impacted by a war, the more you're going to care about it. That's just a time-worn truth. And that's why you see the Polish government running around frantically trying to get grain out of Ukraine and pleading for its fellow democracies to send more weapons to stop the war, because they are right there, very close to the fighting on the border. Same goes for the Baltic countries and others. So they will always feel that danger far more acutely than, say, someone sitting in Madrid or in Portland, Oregon. That being said, it is interesting that the United States Congress has sent, or pledged to send rather, more in aid than the European countries combined. And that speaks, I think, to the concern that even though geographically we may be far away from the actual fighting, that the impact of this war, the second and the third order effects, will certainly have an impact, not just on the United States, but on our interests abroad. So yeah, will there be war weariness? Yes. That's also compounded by the fact that if the White House doesn't get up and explain and say, hey, this is why, you know, we don't want a food crisis in the Middle East, or we don't want Vladimir Putin to feel pressed to use, you know, weapons of mass destruction, because that would set a pretty bad precedent for war fighting in the future. Whatever the rationale may be, you know, the White House has to stand up and talk about that. Otherwise, yes, Americans will care more just naturally about their pocketbooks as the price of food and energy goes through the roof. That's just natural. That's very logical.
Mary Kissel, Executive Vice President, Stevenson Incorporated, former Senior Advisor to the Secretary of State. We turn to Taiwan because one interested party right now, we know with a bad outcome in mind, is Beijing. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.